The man accused of driving drunk in the fatal wrong way crash in Arlington over the weekend had a long history of DUI convictions. But as KIFO Radio's Hannah Scott tells us, under our state DUI laws, none of that was enough to keep him from getting behind the wheel. Right, Hannah?
That's right. A half dozen DUI convictions dating back to 1981, including two in the past 10 years, the most recent in 2016. He was not supposed to be behind the wheel. He had a suspended license and was supposed to have an ignition interlock device. The horrific wrong-way crash killed a 28-year-old woman who was visiting from Oregon. Her sister spoke to KIRO 7.
It definitely feels like a preventable tragedy. This never should have happened.
It's the same story state lawmakers have heard for years from families in our state who've suffered similar tragedies, like Dan Schulte, whose parents were killed and a wife and newborn severely injured when they were run down by Mark Mullen in 2013. A repeat DUI offender with five arrests who was on probation for his latest DUI from just a few months earlier. He was not supposed to be behind the wheel. He had a suspended license and he was supposed to have an ignition interlock device. Sound familiar? So will this.
Of all types of tragedy, this is one of the most preventable types of tragedy.
That's right.
These things, they keep happening, but they don't have to.
That's Dan Schulte testifying before our state lawmakers during one of several hearings over years to change our state law and make a DUI a felony rather than a misdemeanor on a fourth offense rather than the fifth. Karen Bartlett testified at all of those same hearings after her husband Russ was run down and killed in Yakima by a woman with five DUI convictions. She told Kima TV the same thing we're hearing from all of these families.
It's too late for Russ and our family, to have anything done now. But we are looking ahead to other families so that they don't have to endure the same thing that we've had to endure.
Republican State Senator Mike Patton pushed for years after the Schulte case to get a bill making the fourth DUI conviction in 10 years a felony. And it finally did pass last year and is now the law. But it's not enough, according to Patton and Democratic co-sponsor David Frocht, who believe a second or third DUI, at the very least, which is what several other states do, should count as a felony and require prison time, not only the fourth. Frocht had a bill this last session that would also have done away with that 10-year look-back period, meaning anybody with three or more DUIs would face a felony and prison time, regardless of how long ago those offenses were.
Say, hypothetically, this law had been in place in 2016 when this guy got his sixth DUI. That would have, even though it was beyond 10 years back, that would have been a felony, and he probably would have served time in prison. Maybe that would have gotten him in a situation where he could have been cleaned up or certainly off the road.
But despite bipartisan support, Frock says his bill didn't get much traction.
There is a lot of discussion about the costs of incarcerating people who are repeat offenders, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I think there are other areas where we need to have criminal justice reform. This is one where when someone is kind of repeatedly showing that they can't control themselves and whatever treatment options they're getting are not working, we need to be more aggressive.
So that's the plan. In this next session, he will again, along with his Republican supporter, Mike Patton, push this legislation one more time that will do away with that 10-year look-back period. So anybody who has these repeat offenses, mm-hmm. no matter how long ago, will be charged with a felony at least after the third. He also wants to look at what are we doing with ignition interlock devices.
Right.
What's the answer there? Because they can just borrow someone else's car.
Hannah, this seems like such a no-brainer. I mean, there's bipartisan support to do this. Other states have cracked down more on drunk driving. Why are we not able to do that?
As he pointed out there, the cost. So the cost for back when we were trying to get the fourth DUI, there were people who testified there about concerns about the cost, which it was expected to add roughly 276 felony prosecutions a year at a cost of about $10 million every 2 years. I had checked to get the numbers a while back, haven't gotten them. It's only been in place since about a year this month.
But it costs every time there's a wreck or
right?
even just a DUI arrest. You know, the amount of time it takes state troopers to crack down on DUI.
And this will fall because this would be state prison. This should be something that the state legislature has to do appropriations
right.
for and come up with that. So that's something he'll address this next session. He thinks they also need help at the local jurisdiction keeping tabs on these folks. We did have a couple of pilot programs in this state where people who were repeat DUI offenders had to check in a couple of times a day to show that they're sober, to do like a breathalyzer. Other states do that as a whole, as a state. That's another thing he wants to look at. Again, you're talking about cost, and he says
right.
those particular programs are very costly. But you got to keep – we've had so many of these. There was just in April the guy in Kent who died in that crash. He had at least four prior DUIs. So did his brother who was in that car. They didn't test his level because he had died But why was he on the road?
Right. And as we talked about before, just because you're getting a DUI doesn't mean that's the only time you've been driving drunk, right?
No. Yeah. And absolutely. Senator Frock told me that on the phone this morning, that in a lot of cases, the data indicates that these people are out on the road hundreds of times. It's just the times that they get caught that we hear about.
Unbelievable. Thank you, Hannah Scott,
you bet.
On the most recent tragic DUI case. Boy, these keep popping up.
And our next guest is someone you have heard before on Seattle's Morning News, Kristen Gotze. She's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the forthcoming book, which is why you might remember her being on our show. The title is Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence. And she finds that today, when we hear of a candidate like Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez out of New York, few of us actually understand her politics.
I think what people like Ocasio-Cortez are talking about when they're talking about democratic socialism as part of her identity, of course, it's not her entire identity, but I think it's an important part of her identity, is, you know, these large federal platforms, Medicare for all, things like, you know, guaranteed federal support for free college or trade school education. You know, she's also talking about making sure that there aren't homeless people, that people have, Americans have access to houses and food. And she's talking about these things at a federal level. She's hoping to create a caucus within Congress of very progressive Democrats and Democratic socialists who are going to be pushing for these things, not just at the local level, not just at the state level, but also at the federal level. And I think that that's what has really shaken up the establishment, that her victory in New York has sort of, you know, really shocked the Democratic Party establishment, but also I think just shocked, you know, most Americans who didn't really see this coming.
And just observing from the outside, looking at the type of voters and the ideals of somebody like a Democratic Socialist such as Ocasio-Cortez, and then hearing the baby boomer generation react to her win, react to her rise, and react to, you know, the ask from the younger generation who are voting for these candidates, I'm seeing those difference in American ideals start to butt heads, which is she wants universal health care. She wants universal free college. And the baby boomer generation's going, no, it doesn't work that way. In America, you don't get stuff handed to you. So how do you work that out in the political sphere?
So let's just talk about demographics for a moment. According to the Pew Research Center, the millennials will outnumber the baby boomers as of 2019. There'll be 73 million millennials and 72 million baby boomers. And so part of this is a little bit of a numbers game. And one of the things I remember watching on Wednesday, the day after her victory, Mitch McConnell, who is 76, I believe, and Nancy Pelosi, who's 78, reacting from establishment Democrat and an establishment Republican. And the visual was of this young, vibrant Latina woman and these two pretty elderly politicians. It was almost as if you could see the generational, battle lines being drawn just from the visuals. There are these young candidates who are coming up. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, among baby boomers, they associate the word socialism and the policies of socialism with the Cold War. There's a lot of baggage about the history of 20th century state socialism in Eastern Europe. That's a lot of what my own work is about. And I think that for younger voters, they don't associate socialism with Russia or the Soviet Union or Poland or the East German Stasi. They associate democratic socialism with Norway or Sweden or Denmark or Finland or Iceland. They see it as a viable, possible future for this country. And I think that, yes, the baby boomers had a lot going on for them after the Second World War. America was ascendant. The economy was booming. We were a big superpower. The millennials are saddled in debt for colleges. They have very bleak prospects of home ownership. Again, the rise of the gig economy. You know, baby boomers could count on a career that lasted sometimes 30 years. Millennials are never going to have a career that lasts more than a couple years. They're going to bounce from job to job. They're going to be precarious. So they're trying to create a vision of an America for a future, for the world that we live in now. And I think, unfortunately, for the sake of the baby boomers, their ideas of how the politics of this country should work are still based in a vision of an America of the past that's just not an America that exists anymore for people under the age of 30.
Do women or men lean towards socialist candidates?
The data that we have is that, and there have been some opinion polls of millennials, that we see that young millennial women are definitely more inclined toward Democratic Socialist candidates than young millennial men. Now, and there are all sorts of possible reasons for why that might be. But I do think that women, young women, understand perhaps more that in a Democratic polity where you can actually mobilize your base and you can get into elected office and you can make a difference. It's not easy. It takes a lot of work. But I think a lot of young women are coming to the realization that one of the factors influencing their current precarity and their current economic situation is that not enough young people have gone into politics, and especially young women. And because of the current political climate and, you know, potential attacks on women's rights and women's bodily integrity, I think more women are feeling motivated to get into government and actually make the government work for them. The same way that wealthy people in this country, I would argue for the last 30 years, some would argue for a lot longer than that, have really made the government work in their interest. Suddenly, I think young millennial women are waking up to the fact that they can also make the government work in their interest by sheer numbers, by showing up, you know, pounding the pavement, so to speak, like Ocasio-Cortez did, and making a difference.
And she's also engaging, too. I see her on social media, not just participating in back-and-forth attacks like we're seeing now in today's politics, but she's replying with meaningful, substantive information in her replies to anybody, any sitting congressman or woman who decides to question or attack her.
No, and that's what's so amazing about her as, I think, as a young woman. I mean, I read a kind of a Republican analysis of her where they said, you know, this young woman is not from what they called the loony left. You know, she's not loony left. She's very articulate. She's very clear about her ideas. And, you know, again, the big thing is one of the biggest attacks of socialists on socialists is how are you going to pay for free health care for all? How are you going to pay for free college tuition? How are you going to pay for, you know, shelter for America's homeless population? And one of the things I think that has happened since the 2017 Republican Tax Act is that, look, the CBO estimates now that the Tax Act will add $1.7 trillion to the U.S. deficit over the next 10 years. So people like Ocasio-Cortez are saying, if we're going to add $1.7 trillion to the deficit, and that's going to benefit the, you know, 83% of those tax cuts go to the top 1%, why don't we take that money and spread it around and let it help ordinary working Americans, people who are struggling, young people who want to get an education, people who have pre-existing conditions, people who are dealing with the healthcare system. I mean, she is able to articulate a vision clearly, simply, in ordinary language that anybody can understand. And she's young and passionate. And I think that really plays well.
Kristen Godsey, author of the forthcoming book, Why Women Have Better Sex Under Socialism and Other Arguments for Economic Independence. That book comes out in November.
President Trump has sent some sharply worded letters to our NATO allies telling them to pay their fair share. Joining us live is CBS News military analyst and retired Army Major Mike Lyons. Good morning.
Hey, Heather, good to be back with you.
Yeah. Mike, is the president going to get any results from this, or is he just going to kind of rub our allies the wrong way?
Well, he's put out the word that they don't spend enough money. Germany spends 1.2% of its GDP on defense, not even close to what they should be spending. And given where they are in their economic status, they choose to take resources and put them elsewhere. So the president has a point. And we'll see what happens. I think that the other countries now look at if Germany gets away with it, the other countries are going to be able to get away with it. Germany is fundamentally disarmed from a military perspective. They don't have the same capability that they had even 20 years ago.
Now, because of that tension, the Pentagon's actually looking at what might happen if the U.S. moves its troops out of Germany. How complicated might that be? We got a lot of folks there.
Well, it's 35,000 army troops there in particular, down from over 300,000 back during the Cold War. So, you know, I don't think moving them will that make a big difference economically. I think it's really more symbolic. They want to spread them around, so to speak, probably get them out of Germany. I think other NATO countries would be interested in taking them on. Poland, for example, you'd move them closer to Russia, and I think that would potentially cause a problem with Russia, who would perceive that to be a threat. So Germany has not been the greatest of hosts at times with U.S. troops there. And it looks like the administration is going to use that as a threat.
Mike, we've been talking to you about North Korea for a long time. There was a time when we were discussing, can their missiles reach the West Coast? And then we got to a point where President Trump saying there's no nuclear threat from North Korea. However, now we have reports that they are actually still building their nuclear capacity. What do you believe?
Well, you've got to believe that North Korea is going to continue to improve their facilities until the cadre that's doing that is told not to. And a lot of these intelligence reports that have come out are projects that were started 6-8 months ago that they're wrapping up and finishing now. There's clearly a lot inside the media, I think, and sometimes the intelligence community that's trying to put the brakes on what the president has done. We're off to a start. We've got to get there now. Mike Pompeo's there now to try to figure out the project plan, to figure out what exactly is going to take to get some results. We want to get something agreed to by September, which is the next General Assembly meeting of the United Nations. Perhaps Kim Jong-un comes to the U.S., visits New York City, Donald Trump shows him around his town, and we kind of move this process forward. But we're still very much in the beginning of the whole process.
And Mike, how, even if we get Pyongyang to sign off on some of this and get rid of its nuclear weapons, how do we make sure that they're following through on this? It would seem to be a very tricky thing to do with this dictatorship.
Right. I think the tenets of the Iranian deal were pretty good in terms of what the deal was, but we just didn't have any verification. I think this time we're going to have to move people to North Korea. We're going to have to get international inspectors. I think North Korea is not going to necessarily denuclearize. They're going to de-weaponize their nuclear capability, maybe, and that's really what we should be achieving, take away their ballistic missile technology and make sure that they can't launch it. But I think they're going to end up keeping their reactors. They're going to use them for commercial purposes. But the only way to verify is to get people there on the ground, making sure that they're doing what they said they're doing.
Hey, Mike, given all you've seen about this president so far, is he the one to get results from North Korea?
You know, he definitely leans well forward. He seems to take a victory lap before the race has started on some level. The tweet this morning, I think, is a good example of that, because we're at the very beginning of this process. It's got probably 10 to 100,000 tasks on it, and we're probably at, you know, number 5 or 6. So I think that he's got at least the drive and will to see it through, and people that work for him to see it through. And we'll get results. And if we don't get results, you'll see him flip a switch like, you know, no one's tomorrow if he doesn't feel it's going the way that he said that was going to go.
I see what you're talking about with the tweet. Many good conversations with North Korea. It is going well. In the meantime, no rocket launches or nuclear testing in 8 months. All of Asia is thrilled.
Yeah.
He's you know, definitely optimistic.
Yeah, they still have all that capability, and he said we'd be at war now if it wasn't for him. That's probably not the case. We're still going to try to contain North Korea as much as we can.
All right, Mike, thank you so much. A pleasure to talk with you again.
Great, for me.
Yeah, Mike Lyons, CBS News military analyst and retired Army major. Time for a Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. Danny O'Neill, welcome.
Thank you very much. How are you, Heather?
I'm fine. Evidently, Colleen insists she has a job other than this. She's been stalking our Seahawks.
Yes, on so. Instagram. This is, well, who did it start with? John Ryan and Sarah Colonna.
Absolutely, because they're my favorite. Yeah, and we'll start with that one. And then, you know, I think it went to Bam Bam Cam, who I'll still follow, even though, you know, he can't necessarily play anymore. Russell Wilson, Sierra's on there. All the players, really. Earl Thomas is on Instagram.
Who's the weirdest on Instagram? Is it Russell? Russell's strange.
He posts the most puzzling things.
But there's part of me that really likes it, because in a league full of people who are trying to be the coolest in school, Russell's just a dork.
He doesn't need to be the coolest in school.
It's awkward. Like when he posts stuff, Mr. Unlimited.
Yeah, I always want to say Mr. Incredible, but it's Mr. Unlimited.
Mr. Unlimited. Yeah.
But, you know, Sarah, his wife, Sierra, actually reveals more about him than he actually does on his Instagram post. So right now, I believe they're in Shanghai, and he's posting pictures of he and his stepson and daughter. They're making dumplings. They're eating all of these confections in China, having a fun, living it up. I'm not
they're
sure if she's
the
there.
Life.
Yeah, she might be there on a music promotion or something. But I wanted to also mention John Ryan. Who is he coming back to the Seahawks?
Well, he has declared that the Seahawks, he's going to make the Seahawks regret the 5th-round pick they used on the punter, that he's going to beat out the rookie punter.
Okay,
so we'll see. He's going to compete. Yeah, right. Always compete.
Well, I think that maybe in an effort to show that he's dedicated to his position. So he is part owner of the Portland Pickles, correct? Yeah. It's a baseball game, or a baseball team. And at one of the recent games, they gave away a John Ryan bobblehead. He's in a baseball uniform, but he is in kicking form.
That's interesting.
Bobblehead.
Yeah, that's not a skill generally used in baseball, the kick.
Yes, exactly.
Occasionally an umpire will kick, or a manager will kick dirt at an umpire.
Yeah.
However, yeah, kicking generally not involved.
So, you know, I guess that's what you can do as a part owner of a team. But you actually have some goss from Earl Thomas. What did you see on social media?
Yesterday he posted something of saying, life's moving pretty fast this offseason. Just touched down to see here that 31 is stepping away. Best of luck in the new chapter. And then it was a big picture of Earl. And it was just a little odd.
What do you mean?
Well, Earl was wearing sunglasses inside, which I was first of all. But it's an acknowledgement of his teammate, Cam Chancellor. Mm-hmm. Yet it's a picture of Earl. That was kind of strange. It seemed to me that having the retirement of a teammate who came into the league at the same time as Earl and was part of a historically great secondary and a historically great defense. It was just odd to say, like, oh man, I can't believe he's gone. Best of luck in the next chapter.
Just not very intimate, huh?
It seemed a little abrupt. Maybe that's the. Yeah.
Oh, I see. And he's wearing his MAB, his men's adventure bag, as well in the picture.
Hmm. I have no idea those things. That's the man purse?
It is. Yeah. I try not to call it that because I think that people are trying to be derogatory when they say that. But men's adventure bag is what I like to call it.
Really?
Did you not see that?
Is it a fanny pack?
Well, no, it's not a fanny pack. It's a shoulder. It's over the shoulder.
It's a man bag.
Yeah. Man adventure bag. A MAB?
A men's adventure bag. Yeah.
I have to ask you, Cam Chancellor out now, you don't know what you got till you lost it, right? And you're looking at that secondary. Was it the best or one of the best in history? Where would you place it?
Yeah, I do think it was one of the best in history. It's tough to compare eras because different things were allowed. And quite frankly, the Seahawks secondary played in a time when defenses get penalized more often than, say, the San Francisco 49ers secondary from the 80s with Ronnie Lott and Tim McDonald and Tim McIver and some of the players that they had there. The Pittsburgh Steelers defense that they had back then were allowed to do things. And if Cam Chancellor was allowed to hit the way that safety like Darren Woodson of the Cowboys was allowed to hit, you probably would have had the impact that he had would have been greater. But yeah. I would say that, yes, it was the greatest collection. You had three of the best guys at their position. There was a point when you would say Richard Sherman was probably the best corner in the league, if not one of the three best for certain. And Cam Chancellor and Earl Thomas were two of the four best safeties in the league.
Yeah.
That's unbelievable collection of talent to put together.
When's the first event for the Seahawks? I feel like the weather's heating up. It's about time to stand on the surface of the sun and watch a training. I
believe we've got July 27th.
Is that
I might be exactly. It was 4 weeks from last Thursday.
We were looking back at sort of what we did last year around this time, and the Mariners weren't doing so hot. And that's when we did the stalking the Hawks with Colleen. But the Mariners are doing well now. So really, despite talking about the Seahawks today, we have a lot to look forward to sports-wise.
Yeah, the Mariners have a series against the Angels. They come in for three games. Fireworks night will be tonight after the game. One of their fireworks demonstrations, very popular. Tomorrow you got a 1 p.m. start.
Yeah.
It's going to be a great opportunity. The Mariners are 23 games back. They're just a half game out of first place with the Astros. It's absolutely fantastic.
Going to start working on our next sweep.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Break out
the brooms. Are you going to
break out the... No, I can't do Draymond.
They will be back Thursday, so yes, perhaps just in time for another sweep. Uh-huh. Thanks, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Historian Felix Bennell is here with an update on Memorial Stadium at Seattle Center. You've been following this for a while. Some local veterans took the time to honor an Eagle Scout for his good work.
Yeah, and this stadium was built back in 1947. It's a tribute to Seattle School District students who died in World War II. It's been in rough shape for a long time. Back in the fall, then-Mayor Tim Burgess, I think he was mayor for about 15 minutes, he signed an agreement with the school district to preserve the wall as part of a bigger project with all kinds of things with the school district. Different mayor now, of course. And unfortunately, the school district spokesperson who really got this project better than anybody has moved on as of a few weeks ago, so it's a little up in the air again. So I wanted to share this little feel-good story about an event that happened yesterday at the Memorial Wall. That's the heart of the memorial part of Memorial Stadium. The 800 names of the war dead are listed there. You might remember a few months ago we met a high school senior named Peter Gakowski. He organized a cleanup of the wall as part of his Eagle Scout project. So they had this small but meaningful ceremony there yesterday. And I say small because his dad, Joe, was there. I was there, and there were three veterans, Tahoma National Cemetery bugler Bernie Moskowitz, VFW Representative Scott Eliason, and Marine Corps League member Larry Alcantara.
Noticing that the wall was partly obscured by trash stewing overgrowth hedges, Peter leapt into action. The first hurdle was securing approval from the Seattle School District and the City of Seattle. No small feat in itself. And upon hearing of Peter's remarkable choice, the first thought I had was the Leatherneck Honor Guard's motto. Only the forgotten are truly dead.
And that's the confounding thing about this memorial wall. It's 500 yards from probably the busiest tourist attraction in the region, where millions of people go to the Space Needle. They walk past this thing, and it just remains this little curio because it's been turned into a parking lot. Literally, there's bumpers right up against the base of the memorial. So Marine Corps vet Larry Alcantara made the formal presentation.
I present to you the Marine Corps League Good Citizenship Award, presented to Peter Joseph Gokowski, who has attained the rank of Eagle Scout, signed Commandant Mark Gorman, Adjutant Stephen Knox, this July 2, 2018. Thank you for your service and congratulations.
Thank you.
You can barely hear Peter's voice there saying thank you. He's a very humble kid, you know, and he didn't do this project for the attention. You know, he played football for O'Day and was at the stadium, and he asked his dad one day, what's that wall all about? And his dad told him, and they researched it and figured it out. So we were there yesterday, and this massive hedge trimming that Peter and his friends had done to restore the memorial, it had kind of grown back. And so I asked Peter, you know, how he felt about the honor and all this, the certificate he was getting and the veterans there. And he gave me a fairly standard response, then went right to the practical need to do more about the vegetation.
It makes me feel good about what I did and how it made a positive impact on the community and how I hope it influences other scouts to do the same and make bigger progress on eventually probably taking out the bush, because it honestly shouldn't be there.
So sort of it was a gratitude, but also let's get rid of that bush that's in front of them.
Why can't they just get rid of
all
it?
All that hard work.
Yeah, this thing's in limbo because the property belongs to the school district, but it's abuts Seattle Center. It was given to the school district by the city in the 40s on the condition they have a stadium there. It's kind of in limbo.
But to remove a bush, like it seems like a decision that could be made in 2 seconds at the school board meeting.
It used to have fountains and lights. It used to be this grand plaza. Now it's a parking lot.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing. Yeah.
It's too bad.
So, but standing there after the ceremony, the vets all agreed that even though we're in a parking lot, there's no way around the fact that it's hallowed ground.
These are patriot citizens who, at a young age, paid the price for our freedom. And they should never be forgotten.
So I would say stay tuned. And if you feel like weighing in, let the Seattle School District know what you think. Let the mayor's office know what you think about the memorial wall and the stadium. Can we play a little bit of Taps?
Sure.
At the end of the ceremony, the bugler from Mount Tahoma Cemetery played this beautiful rendition of Taps.
Detail. About face.
I don't think we can hear the whole thing, but we do have images and videos and all sorts of great stuff at MyNorthwest.com about this wonderful ceremony yesterday at Memorial Stadium.
Thank you for covering this, Felix. I understand, you know, there were a few people there, but it's important to mark these occasions. That's why you're important to our region.
Absolutely. Thank you.
President Trump is interviewing judges looking for the next Supreme Court justice. He says he's narrowed his list of replacements for Anthony Kennedy to 7. Let's go live to the Washington Post and Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Ferenthal. Good morning.
Morning.
David, who do you think is bending the president's ear on the Supreme Court pick?
I think pretty much everybody on the right. There's the Federalist Society, which has been vetting these judges for a long time, now sort of getting them down to this list of 4. But now you're seeing individual senators, members of Congress, advocacy groups pushing their favorites. This is a president who often says yes to the last person he talked to. I think people recognize that, and that may only ramp up the pressure on him to choose one judge or the other.
All the predictions I'm hearing is it's going to be conservative. That's kind of a done deal. Do you agree?
Yes, it's going to be. I think some of my colleagues put out a list of 4 judges today, and they're all conservative justices or judges.
Anyone you think might be the favorite going into this?
With Trump, it's really hard to handicap. The two that have been talked about the most are Brett Kavanaugh, who was once a clerk for Kennedy, and Amy Coney Barrett. I believe both of them are appellate judges now who would be sort of elevated to higher in the system. But there's a couple others there, too. I would not make a bet on any of them because it's a little unpredictable at this point.
All right. You think he'll stick with his timeline?
I think so. I mean, I think he, I don't think he's going to put it, like, it's not like he's sitting at Bedminster reading their legal opinions. I think it's going to be based probably on his personal rapport with them and maybe a little bit on whose advice he gets. I do think he set Monday as the deadline for sort of the big reveal, and I think it'll happen then.
Colleen and I were wondering, in light of the Capital Gazette shooting, I'm wondering how you're feeling, quite frankly, because I know that at times you've written things that have had you under threats. What did you think when you found out about that?
Oh, it's horrible. I worked in the Post-Annapolis Bureau a few years ago, knew people from the Capital Gazette, knew that area really well. It's a terrible thing. So we personally, or, you know, at the Washington Post, we've got a big office. We've got security downstairs. We've got a little more security now in the wake of that shooting. So, you know, we were always better protected than the Capital Gazette folks who, you know, were in a small office in an office park with just a glass door between them and the outside world. So there's some more security and working for a bigger operation. I think folks who are in smaller newsrooms are under greater threat. But, you know, all of us have had to deal with cranks and crazies. Newspapers attract them, right? There's always nuts calling the newspaper demanding one thing or another. We serve as a kind of a convenient place to focus your anger at the world. And so what this guy was, the accused shooter in this case, was just, you know, was a particularly threatening crank. He was just the kind of person that a lot of newsrooms deal with. And the idea had always been, what, you know, well, these people are all talk. You know, this proved it just takes one case and you have a huge tragedy.
Yeah. And you know, I've been sort of reflective a lot, David, even before this Capital Gazette shooting, and just wondering, you know, the state of journalism and the image of journalism in America. I know that this shooter in no way has been tied back to, you know, the president's rhetoric about media and reporters. But I wonder sometimes, you know, where do we go from here as journalists to push back against an obvious attack on the job that we do from the president and others?
You're right. It's a terrible message that the president is sending. I should say, first of all, journalists in America still are accorded a huge degree of respect, and it's a safer job in America than it is in a whole lot of other countries around the world. So we're under a lot less threat than folks are in Russia or Turkey or a lot of other places. But the president calling us the enemy of the people, saying we lie to undermine him, those things can't help that atmosphere. And I think you've seen in the last couple of years attacks on journalists both from the left and from the right. People have been attacked at protests by leftist protesters, folks that have been threatened at Trump rallies. It doesn't serve the good of our democracy to have the people who are out there reporting the facts feel like they're under threat from one side or both sides.
Is it just a matter of education? Is it re-educating the public on what exactly we do as journalists?
I think that's got to be part of it. I mean, the politicians have to take some responsibility for this, too. I mean, you can't separate that from, you know, there's a moral responsibility in those who lead our country to make sure people understand that journalists are there to do a job that we all need and we all find valuable. For us, I think that part of it has to be, yes, educating people on the valuable work we do, and also, you know, sticking to our principles in this time of threat, right? Yeah. We don't gain anything by taking on this idea, you know, that from President Trump, from his Steve Bannon, his former advisor, that they're at war with the media, right? If we take on that mindset, oh, we're at war with Donald Trump, we only hurt ourselves and we destroy the credibility that gives us our sort of hallowed place in American society. So we can't let ourselves be swayed to feeling like we're on a war footing just because other people think they're at war with us.
And it's hard, too, because we're not trained to or used to being the story. So even talking about this feels a little funny, but perhaps it is time to have more of a conversation with the public about what we do. Let's then turn it away from us and back to politics. We're still months away from the midterms. We haven't held our primary here in our state yet, but, you know, based on the outcome in New York with the Democratic Socialists heading to the November ballot, any early predictions or what's happening in that arena?
I do think the Democrats are going to make gains. It's, you know, looking at the latest polls, you see some generic ballots with Democrats up 7, 8, 9 points, even 10 points in some cases. That might be enough to flip the House. You'd think, wow, a 10 point lead, they're going to definitely flip the House, but Democrats are sort of packed into districts because of gerrymandering, so it might take a 7 or 8 point percentage point Democratic win nationwide to actually turn the House from red to blue. I'm really interested in seeing whether there's more victories like this one in New York, where the Democratic Socialist, the young woman, took on this guy, Joe Crowley, who was seen by many people as kind of a House Speaker in waiting, but had apparently lost his attention and his love in his own district. I'm interested to see that her kind of ideology, her kind of message, you know, which is the government needs to step in and protect the poor from the rich. The government needs to take a bigger role in fighting climate change and in providing health care for everyone. Those kind of messages that, you know, and even taking on the word socialist, which is, you know, for a long time was the sort of worst thing you could call someone in America. That's fascinating that that worked. On the other hand, I think we shouldn't read too much into her victory because it's a very, very blue district, and it was an extremely low turnout election. She won that election with like 20,000 votes, you know, which wouldn't even be a city council victory in most cities. So, you know, she's a really interesting candidate, but I don't think we can say she's a bellwether for anything yet.
But is she telling us we cannot underestimate that millennial vote? I mean, that definitely is her generation, some of the things I'm hearing from the millennials. And what do the Democrats have to do as far as mobilizing them to get them out to vote?
Well, I think that's going to be a huge question for the Democrats come this fall. There's a huge amount of energy and enthusiasm among young people. I say that as a 40-year-old, so I'm including everybody under about 38 in that description. But the Democrats, the people who lead the Democratic Party, their visible leaders, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, are old. They're, you know, they're retirement age or beyond. So I think they're counting on this, you know, the idea from Pelosi and those folks had been, well, this huge surge of young voters will put us back into power. And I think maybe what they didn't anticipate was that those people want Democrats to be in power, but maybe not the same Democrats. Maybe a group of people who are younger and more diverse and who look like the folks that are voting for them.
I think they go ahead. Yeah, I think they can't underestimate the ground game either. There was a lot of talk about how effective President Obama was in getting people out and getting them to vote and getting people who didn't typically do that to turn out. And then a lot of criticism against Clinton for not doing the same. So that would seem to be key to me.
Right. I mean, the thing that Ocasio-Cortez had in New York that was similar to Bernie Sanders and similar to Barack Obama, throw aside ideology, it was a sense of you are part of a movement. You know, you, the voter, are doing this. This is your movement. I'm part of it, too. I'm at the head of it. But this is a movement, and you're part of it. And think of all those ads Bernie Sanders ran with, like, you know, this is a revolution, and you're part of it. Clinton had a different idea. Clinton was sort of focused on her. I'm a great candidate. I'm very qualified. Vote for me. And it didn't make people feel like they were part of any movement. Obviously, she got more votes than Trump anyway. But it will be interesting to see the way that individual Democratic candidates, how they create that kind of enthusiasm where people who are voting feel like they're doing something rather than just putting somebody else in to do something.
All right. Thank you so much. David Therenthal with the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner.